From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, recovering from the earthquake in Nepal. Captives freed from Boko Haram. We'll have the latest on the U.S. police custody death, plus music forged from metal. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Rescue workers in Nepal on Thursday pulled two survivors from the rubble of last weekend's devastating earthquake. Rare moments of joy as the death toll has climbed to nearly 6,000. Teams of rescue workers from across the world continued digging through rubble, and aid groups worked to get much-needed supplies to the survivors. VOA correspondent Steve Herman visited a village northeast of the capital, Kathmandu.
We've traveled over a road which has just been cleared of landslides in a four-wheel drive vehicle, and then from a smaller earthquake damaged road, we've hiked down a trail on a steep terrace paddy field to the banks of the Indravati River, and we are now in a village called Majigal, where every single structure has been reduced to a pile of rubble. We're talking about 50 homes in all. The human toll is remarkably low, considering the utter devastation. Five people dead, one teenage boy is missing, about 20 injured have been taken away, and there are still a few of the seriously injured who cannot move are still in the village. Besides the total loss of their houses and concern about how they're going to rebuild, and even if they should rebuild these similar type of structures, fearing another earthquake in the future, the big tragic loss for the people here in Majigal, which has primarily been a fishing community, and we've heard this from all the villages we've stopped in, is the loss of their livestock. What happened here, when the earthquake struck, it was in the hot part of the day. People were taking their meal break, and they had tied up all their livestock in the shed. So when the earthquake hit, the animals could not flee. And so each family had five or six animals, whether they were goats, chickens, cows, whatever. They've lost them all. And this is just a tremendous financial loss for all these people.
That is VOA Steve Herman in Nepal. The UN launched an urgent appeal earlier this week for $415 million to provide shelter for 500,000 people who are outside, sleeping outdoors. They're also putting out a call for medicine, water, food for the millions affected by the earthquake. The UN said the disaster destroyed 130,000 houses and damaged thousands more. There is full coverage of the recovery from the earthquake in Nepal at our website, voanews.com. Also in the news, the Nigerian army says it has freed another 150 people who were held captive by the militant group Boko Haram. An army spokesman told VOA that troops rescued about 100 children and 50 women as they fought their way through the Sambisi forest in northeastern Nigeria. The vast forest holds many Boko Haram camps and is believed to be the place where the group took many of the thousands of Nigerians it kidnapped over the past few years. Rescuers have raised hopes that some of the 219 missing schoolgirls kidnapped from the town of Chibok last year would be found. However, initial statements from the army indicated that none of the Chibok girls were among those who were freed. Cameroon is home to about 200,000 Central African Republic refugees who fled the carnage in their country. As the Central African Republic prepares for next week's National Reconciliation Forum, reporter Moki Edwin Kinzika met some refugees in Cameroon to find out what they expect from the initiative.
This is Belmonde Jose, a 35-year-old emissary of cleric from the Central African Republic, speaking to his country's refugees in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, about the reconciliation process to recover from more than 2 years of sectarian violence. But his audience is mostly pessimistic. One of these refugees is car washer Anselm Blaise Kaminga, who says he is still traumatized by the brutal murder of his wife and three children in Bangui. He is not interested in a reconciliation, which he believes may free those responsible for the bloodshed. He says no matter the outcome of the reconciliation process, he will never return to his country because he's lost all of his family. David Zamgang is a former student at the University of Bangui and is now night watchman in Yaoundé. For him, the most important priority is getting a credible government so that the healing begins at home rather than as an initiative of the international community.
Dans tout pays où il faut aller dans le bon sens, où il faut la paix, il faut toujours qu'il y ait élection pour que...
He says any country that wants to develop must start by organizing elections in which its citizenry freely chooses who will represent them. He says he also expects accountability from holders of public office. Hawker Simon Pierre Makdongo, who also fled from the University of Bangui, where he studied history, is not hopeful. He says his country has a history of political division and doesn't see solutions.
Madame Samba Paza, c'est que moi j'attends de vous. C'est la même chose qu'on a dit aux autres.
He says what the world is expecting from CAR interim president Catherine Samba Panza has never been achieved under her predecessors. He says he has no plans to return home because of galloping youth unemployment and poor pay for the few who have jobs. Groundnut retailer Jenge Dian, who fled Bangui a year ago, says she doesn't think reconciliation is possible.
Non, je ne rentre pas. Comme le pays c'est bon d'abord, je rentre, mais le pays ce n'est pas bon, ça commence encore.
She says she has seen so many reconciliations, but her country has never been at peace since she was born. She says no reconciliation can replace all her family and friends killed by ruthless people. One of the few voices of hope among those VOA spoke to is a refugee who took part in the violence. Gilibery Dimanga, who says he fought with one of the rival factions before escaping to Cameroon, says it is high time to stop the rivalry and work for the development of their war-ravaged country.
Because on arrête la guerre. La guerre n'est pas bonne. J'essaie de s'entretuer et de faire du mal aux gens qui...
He says he regrets he was deceived into killing innocent people and adds that he is praying for peace and wants his fellow citizens to show the courage needed for reconciliation. Aid workers here say they are hoping for major progress so refugees can return home. Ngu Paul Simon, with the NGO Friends for Refugees or FOR, says some refugees are ready to return.
Some of the refugees have come to us and ask for transport to go back to their country when they so desire. Most of them either want to go to school and so on, so we sponsor them.
Conflicts began in CAR in 2013 after mostly Muslim Seleka rebels overthrew the government, leading to reprisals from Christians who formed anti-Balaka militias. Most of the victims were civilians. Current efforts to reconcile rival factions are sponsored by the European Union and the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is urging immigrants being attacked in South Africa to return to their homes. His remarks came at the end of a meeting of the Southern African Development Community leaders looking at how the region can industrialize. Sebastian Mofu reporting from Harare.
At the end of the one-day meeting, leaders from the Southern African Development Community, SADC, issued a communique saying the region commended the measures that South Africa's government has put in place to ensure that recent attacks on immigrants do not recur. Mr. Mugabe, who is chairing SADC in the African Union, told reporters that there was no reason for Africans to move to South Africa, the continent's second biggest economy.
Our people should not have the instincts of rushing into South Africa. There are people who voluntarily, they think South Africa is the heaven, our heaven in Southern Africa. Yes, it's more highly developed, true. But go there and you'll see that the Africans in the country are still very low. It's the whites who are leading better lives.
Estimates say Zimbabweans may form the largest group of immigrants in South Africa affected by the xenophobic attacks. They have been estimated at 3 million. Before leaving for the meeting in Harare, South African President Jacob Zuma said he wanted the issue discussed, even though it was not on the agenda. Malawi's President Peter Mutharika also indicated he wanted the SADC to address the issue of xenophobia. The outgoing government of Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has recalled the acting Nigerian High Commissioner to South Africa to protest how Pretoria handled the attacks that claimed 7 lives. The African Union has said it welcomes efforts by South Africa to curb the violence, but more must be done to protect African and other foreign migrants. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
U.S. health officials are closing down a treatment unit they set up in Liberia at the height of the Ebola crisis last year as that country prepares to be declared free of the Ebola virus. Liberia has now gone 32 days without a new Ebola case, and if it stays that way until May the 9th, World Health Organization likely will declare the country Ebola-free. U.S. government last year deployed more than 2,000 troops to fight Ebola in Liberia, setting up 15 treatment centers. The troops were withdrawn in February as the number of cases declined. World Health Organization said the virus has killed more than 10,000 people. Most of them are in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. At least 24,300 have been infected since the outbreak began in December of 2013. And the WHO is saying that an increasing number of infections are no longer treatable because of growing antimicrobial resistance, putting the lives of millions of people at risk. We get more now from Lisa Schlein at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The WHO study finds no region in the world is prepared to combat this serious global threat. Only one quarter of the 133 countries has a comprehensive plan to fight resistance to antibiotics and other antimicrobial medicines. The survey also finds public awareness of the issue remains generally low, and many people believe antibiotics are effective against viral infections. It says this leads to antibiotics being used when they are not required or effective, which can lead to resistance. WHO coordinator for antimicrobial resistance, Charles Penn, says the survey also shows the sale of antibiotics and other antimicrobial medicines without a prescription is widespread throughout the world. He says this increases the potential for overuse, thereby worsening the problem of resistance.
Without urgent action, the world is heading for what is being termed a post-antibiotic era, in which common infections and minor injuries that have been treatable for decades may once again kill. And we will lose the ability to treat a range of serious conditions such as bloodstream infections, pneumonia, tuberculosis, malaria, HIV, and the benefits of advanced medical treatment such as cancer chemotherapy and major surgery will also become much riskier and may well be lost.
Penn makes clear this is not a future problem. He tells VOA there are diseases and infections today that are no longer treatable with available antibiotics.
We often give the example of gonorrhea, where around the world there are examples of cases of this which do not respond to any of the antibiotics available to us. Another example would be hundreds of thousands of new cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis each year. Again, these are infections that have already become very difficult to treat. And it's difficult to put a precise number on what will happen in the future, but if we don't act, then it can only get worse.
A draft global action plan to combat antimicrobial resistance, including antibiotic resistance, will be discussed during next month's World Health Assembly. The plan emphasizes the need for improved diagnostic tools so doctors have clear guidance as to when to prescribe antibiotics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Protesters held another large but peaceful march through downtown Baltimore here in the United States Thursday night. Speculation growing about the findings of a police report on the death of Freddie Gray. He's the 25-year-old African-American man who died April the 19th after a severe spinal injury that is, while he was in police custody. His death sparked some rioting as well as some neighborhood difficulties in Baltimore. VOA discussed the Gray case earlier Thursday with a U.S. criminal justice analyst at the advocacy group Center of American Progress. Here's what analyst Todd Cox had to say about how Baltimore officials should handle the public's reaction to the eventual release of the investigation's findings.
Without forecasting, obviously, what the report will say or how it will be handled, I think in all of these kinds of matters, what communities really need to hear is that their elected officials understand and acknowledge their concerns, understand and acknowledge their outrage, and are taking whatever comes down in terms of the report and in terms of an internal investigation seriously, and that they need to ensure that whatever the report says, whatever comes out, they will take it seriously and will take whatever actions are necessary to, number one, bring justice to this particular matter, but number two, ensure that whatever reforms need to take place so that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Freddie Gray died of spinal injuries earlier this month, days after police chased him on the streets, pinned him down on the ground, arrested him. He was carrying a knife. They then put him into a police van, but he was not secured, and apparently the seatbelt was not attached, as is required. For the first time in the history of Major League Baseball, the Baltimore Orioles this week played a game without fan attendance. The reason was that ongoing unrest in the city of Baltimore, but increased security is now required at all ballparks throughout the country. It's a move mandated by the Major League Baseball Commissioner in consultation with the Department of Homeland Security. VOA's Adam Phillips went to Yankee Stadium in New York City to get the reaction of fans.
All gates are open. They are short of lines if you follow my direction.
With baseball luminaries like Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Derek Jeter to boast about, not to mention its legendarily loyal fans, the New York Yankees Baseball Club is steeped in tradition and lore. Even Lenny, an older man dressed in an American flag-themed clown suit, cheering himself hoarse outside the stadium, is a familiar, much-beloved sight among hardcore Yankee fans. But there's also a distinctly high-tech sound just outside Yankee Stadium and 29 other major league ballparks this year. Metal detectors, dozens of them, just a few tantalizing meters from the entrance gates.
Hello. Would you kindly place your bag inside the basket? Loose change, cell phone, keys.
Baseball officials and the Department of Homeland Security say the threat of terrorist strikes at ballparks and other crowded urban venues requires security and safety measures that once might have been considered extreme. Fan Frank Phillips takes the new safety measures in stride.
I can tolerate anything. You know, I enjoy going to the Yankees, and if that's what makes everyone feel more secure, I'm pleased for everybody.
Steve Sloan, a well-dressed fan who seems to have just come from a boardroom, mostly agrees.
I'm okay with it. As long as it doesn't make me take off my shoes, I'm okay. It's not as bad as the airport, so.
What would the shoes be a difference for you?
It's cold. My feet would get dirty.
Nearby, Michael Jones says he feels safer here than he has for years.
You know, there's too many nut jobs out there. You need to be safe. Not everybody's a nice guy like me and you. Unfortunately, we live in a different world than when you and I were kids. We didn't make it that way, but it is, and you got to live with it.
but a man who would only give his name as Corey resents the new measures.
I don't like it. I take our chances. Let people do what they want. Let people be free. I think everyone's, for the most part, is going to be cool, and we'll police ourselves.
A middle-aged husband and wife team, a few paces away, take a somewhat wistful middle path.
I think the metal detectors are just like one more symbol of the society we live in, and I think it's really sad, and it takes longer for us to get into the park. But if we're really going to be safe, then I appreciate having them. I just don't think we're any safer this year than we were last year.
It kind of gives you a bad feeling.
Yeah, but I'm still going in.
I think it's just a slow, incremental change in the world that only people who are over a certain age even notice. People don't remember the age before cell phones. They don't remember the age before you had to take your shoes off to get on an airplane. But some of us do, and it makes me a little worried about what my son's world is going to be when he's my age.
It's a well-known mix. Sports, controversy, the inevitability of change, nostalgia, and now the terrorist threat. Whatever else they do, the new security measures will give fans something to talk about before they hear the national anthem and the words, play ball. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
You know, sometimes you can feel the clear sound of a bell from your head to your feet. Well, take that idea and think big, and you'll have an idea of what Augusta Reed Thomas is trying to do with Resounding Earth. The piece is scored exclusively for metals and features more than 125 bells from a variety of cultures and historic periods. VOA's Carol Pearson has more on this unique work of percussion.
Award-winning American composer Augusta Reed Thomas. This is the sound of the earth.
I've always been attracted to bell-like sounds. The title, Resounding Earth, on the one hand, we're talking about resounding earth, this earth that is full of metals that all of mankind has turned into instruments, and we're going to play them from all around the world together on one stage.
Thomas says her composition is like a United Nations of resonances.
Yeah, these are Indian Noah bells, or Kadki.
On a recent Sunday, the members of Third Coast Percussion were setting up the instruments to rehearse Resounding Earth. The Chicago-based quartet was invited to perform the piece at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. Peter Martin is one of the musicians.
We have bells that come from India. We have gongs that come from Thailand. We have other bells that come from all over the European continent. Literally every continent, I believe, is represented in the instrumentation.
Some are locally found objects.
It is a spring coil from heavy machinery. Makes a beautiful sound. It's not built to be a musical instrument, but it makes a beautiful sound.
Altogether, Resounding Earth incorporates over 350 metal objects, ranging from tiny cluster bells to huge Chinese gongs. Thomas developed the piece in close collaboration with the Third Coast percussionists.
It was very challenging, yeah, just being able to figure out the distinct sound qualities of each one of the instruments and then to be able to play them in a way that sort of balanced them across each other. And that was both a difficulty for ourselves as performers, but also for the composer herself, who was trying to craft a piece.
Martin says the 35-minute opus was many years in the making, and every move of the players was carefully choreographed. The work has four movements. One is scored exclusively for 26 Japanese rins, or singing bowls, creating a meditative sound. 18 Burmese spinning bells, traditionally played by monks, are a central component of another section.
But it's also resounding Earth, you know, to take what's in the Earth and resound it. And in that sense, it's really giving it back to the Earth, giving it back to the people. It's been a very beautiful journey.
The composer and the players say they would love to take the music to all the places where the bells were made and share their resonance with people around the world. For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And the first spacecraft to orbit Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, will run out of fuel and crash on the Earth, on the surface there today, ending an 11-year mission. Time to say goodbye and thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aiden Uku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Himalayan country of Nepal suffered a devastating earthquake over the weekend, measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale. More than 5,000 people are known dead in Nepal, with more than 10,000 injured, according to Nepalese authorities. But those numbers are expected to rise further as information emerges from more remote areas. Additional deaths have been reported in India, China, and Bangladesh. The city of Kathmandu contains many small, poorly constructed brick apartment buildings. Many people are sleeping outside for fear of additional aftershocks and falling debris. While more modern structures came through the quake fairly unscathed, many religious and cultural sites in Kathmandu that survived previous earthquakes are now in ruins. Rescuers are sifting through temples' rubble by hand in order to safely extricate survivors, bodies, or priceless artifacts buried within. The earthquake also set off deadly avalanches on Mount Everest, killing at least 18 people in the mountain's base camp. The United States, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement, sends its deepest condolences to all of those affected by the earthquake in Nepal and neighboring countries. The United States is working closely with the government of Nepal to provide assistance and support. U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, Peter Bodhi, issued a disaster declaration in order to immediately release an initial $1 million for emergency assistance. 2 days later, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $9 million in assistance to address life-saving priorities, including search and rescue efforts, the provision of shelter, water, and emergency health care. U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has deployed a 128-person disaster assistance response team to coordinate the U.S. government's response efforts. Included in this team are two urban search and rescue units that are working to find survivors. U.S. military medics are in Kathmandu and are coordinating with the Nepal Army on how best to assist. The U.S. will continue to coordinate assistance with the Nepalese government. To the people in Nepal and the region affected by this tragedy, said Secretary Kerry, the United States stands with you at this difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.